From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Robot Stories is a new film about the emotional interaction between humans and cutting-edge technology. One reviewer calls it heartbreakingly romantic. On today's Fresh Air, we meet filmmaker Greg Pak. Robot Stories is his first feature film, and it's collecting awards on the festival circuit. Also, Hollywood celebrities from Britney Spears to Elizabeth Taylor have embraced Kabbalah, the tradition of Jewish mysticism dating back to the Middle Ages. We'll talk with scholar Daniel Matt, who's translating the central text of the Kabbalah, the Zohar. Also, critic Milo Miles reviews Punk Rock, the new live recording by the Mekons taken from their 2002 tour. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The leader of Haiti's rebels, Guy Philippe, said today that he'll disarm his forces and leave the capital. NPR's Jerry Haddon says Philippe has apparently given up his plan to take charge of Haiti's security.
He said that the international community had promised to provide security for the Haitian people, and therefore, as he had promised, he would lay down his weapons and his men would lay down their weapons. Now that Aristide is no longer in Haiti, Guy Philippe met with the Marine colonel in charge of the multinational force here, Colonel Berger, and came out of that meeting, said it was very cordial, and that he would lay down his weapons and return to the northern city of Gonaïves.
NPR's Jerry Haddon in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. U.S. and Iraqi officials say they're holding a total of 15 people in connection with yesterday's attacks on Shiite Muslim shrines in Baghdad and Karbala. The head of Iraq's governing council says the death toll has risen to 271. NPR's Steve Inskeep has more from Baghdad.
A senior U.S. official says investigators are still trying to determine how the attackers got the explosives into the center of Karbala. One theory points to the carts that many celebrating Muslims were pushing through the streets, some of which could have concealed bombs. The investigation has also led authorities to the 15 people, some of whom are being detained by Iraq's government and some by the U.S. The official did not name the men or describe any evidence against them, but he says that four are speakers of Farsi. That fact might suggest the men were among the many pilgrims who've come to this country from Iran. Iraqi officials are often eager to blame such attacks on foreigners who have been linked to some bombings here. But in at least one recent incident, suspected foreigners later turned out to be Iraqis after all. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Baghdad.
Senator John Edwards has officially ended his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination and called on his supporters to help Senator John Kerry win in November.
This calls this challenge to change America. Now it belongs to you. You should not step back. You should step up. It is up to every single one of you to make certain that in our America, our children can prosper and grow.
Edwards made his announcement in Raleigh, North Carolina. Dozens of same-sex couples lined up to be married today in Portland, Oregon, after county officials there announced they'd issue marriage licenses to gay and lesbian partners. And the county officials say it would be unconstitutional to deny the licenses to same-sex couples, but Oregon's Republican governor is calling on the state's attorney general to stop the weddings. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 2 points to close at 10,593 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 6 points to close at 2033. This is NPR News. The former head of WorldCom pleaded not guilty today to federal fraud charges. Bernard Ebbers was released on $10 million bond. The government charged the former CEO with fraud, conspiracy, and making false statements in connection with the company's $11 billion accounting scandal and bankruptcy. Ebbers' attorney said the trial, set for November, would clear his client's name. The Federal Reserve's Beige Book survey indicates the economy expanded in January and into last month. The survey combines reports from the Fed's 12 regional banks. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
On balance, the latest Federal Reserve Beige Book report shows an economy that was either growing moderately or, in the case of three Fed districts, even accelerating heading into the new year. The report showed the strongest growth in the New York, Richmond, and Dallas districts. Consumer spending was up in most Fed districts, with sales gains reported in every region except St. Louis. But perhaps most striking was the strength in manufacturing. Manufacturing output rose in 11 of 12 Fed districts. The only exception was Cleveland, where it held steady. Also positive was employment, which, according to the report, has been growing slowly. The data will likely be reviewed by policymakers when the Fed meets later this month to consider interest rates, though most analysts don't expect the Fed to take any action on rates at that session. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
A Senate panel heard testimony on the issue of same-sex marriage today. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist said that marriages between gay and lesbian couples would, in his words, spread like wildfire unless Congress approves a constitutional amendment banning the practice. Critics such as Senator Russ Feingold, a Wisconsin Democrat, called the attempt to amend the Constitution a divisive political exercise. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces All Songs Considered 4, the newest compilation of music heard on NPR programs at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Filmmaker Greg Pak's first feature-length movie, Robot Stories, has been described as a work about love, death, and robots. It's an anthology of four stories of people in the immediate future interacting with technology that's almost human. Greg Pak grew up in Dallas, Texas, in a Korean-American family. He came to filmmaking after studying political science at Yale and history as a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. His previous work includes a series of short films, including a documentary about his Korean grandfather called Fighting Grandpa. Besides writing screenplays and producing his own films, Greg Pak runs several websites, including one on Asian film, and has even dabbled in Texas politics. Pak got Robot Stories noticed one audience at a time, taking it to more than 50 film festivals, building a following, and winning awards, 29 in all. Let's begin with a clip from Robot Stories. A couple, played by Tamlin Tamita and James Saito, are at an agency preparing to adopt a baby. But when the white-coated staff present the bundle of joy, it turns out to be a robot swaddled in a baby blanket. The staff is explaining how to care for the electronic infant.
This is the bottle. It's actually a recharging unit for his batteries.
Oh.
The tip fits right there. You'll know he's full when it starts to beep.
So how often do we need to feed him?
Every 3 hours or so. He'll let you know when he's hungry.
What else do we need to do? Feed him, keep him warm?
We rig him to leak a little graphite after feedings. Wipe him off or he'll bust out crying.
Sounds pretty manageable.
Well, there's a little more to it than that. He has the G9 processor, which means he'll learn and grow. He'll become his own little person, based largely on his experiences with you. So you want to treat Bobby the way you would a human baby. Hold him, talk to him, play with him. In short, love him. His hard drive will record all of the nurturing you give, so when we download at the end of the month, we'll be able to see how well you cared for him. And then we'll see what we can do about getting you a real baby.
Greg Pak, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
Now, where did this idea come from of a parent training robot?
You know, I grew up in Dallas, Texas, and in middle school, all the kids in health class at a certain point had to carry around baskets, and in those baskets were little eggs, and they had to see how long they could go without breaking the egg. And, it's one of those don't get pregnant kids cautionary exercises, I think. But that always stuck with me, this notion of an egg that you had to take care of. So, I don't know, for some reason that robot baby always was going to be egg-shaped for me. I think it was also inspired in some way by the Tamagotchi craze, if you remember that. It was a little electronic toy that kids had to take care of, and if they had to feed it periodically, and if they didn't take care of it, it would die, and small children would burst into tears in kindergarten and everything. But Yeah, it's funny because I remember when my dad read the screenplay, he said, "You know, you better make this pretty quick because somebody's going to do that."
It struck me, and I think it's going to strike a lot of people, as maybe not a terrible idea. I mean, a lot of people say that people ought to have licenses to be parents.
You know, the crazy thing is actually a friend sent me a link recently, and apparently there is some school in Australia, I think, that has built a robot. They've got a baby doll with electronics in it that can tell when it's being held improperly and stuff like that. So it's actually, you know, a few steps away from actually coming true.
Well, it's interesting that I think this is a very compelling tale, and it's interesting to me that the baby robot here looks nothing at all like a human baby. It looks like, I guess, about a 2-foot-long Easter egg with with big dopey eyes and kind of 1950s-looking robotic movements.
Yep.
I know that you didn't have a big budget for this film, but you certainly could have gotten a more human-looking like robot to play the parent training robot here. Why did you choose that kind of an image?
You know, it was a conscious choice because my thought was that the agency would want to give these parents something that's alien, something that's a little strange, because most of the time I think people immediately bond with their child. You know, they just love this child irrationally and devotedly and, you know, without hesitation. But there are also parents who don't quite feel that connection with their baby. And I think that would be something that when, you know, if there were an adoption agency that wanted to test for that kind of a thing, I think they would be smart to give people a baby that's not quite so cute. You know what I mean? If you're going to give somebody a robot baby to take care of to see if they're going to be good parents, if you give them an incredibly bondable little robot, something that's immediately charming and wonderful, then it may not be as good a test as if you give somebody something that's a little strange, you know, a little scary. I remember also, I mean, that story was also inspired by just talking to my mom at different points. I remember once when I was a kid, my little sister, I remember playing with my little sister and giving her a frog that I'd caught. And she just, you know, she was like 2 years old or 3 years old, and she didn't know, and she just squeezed it and killed it. And I was kind of horrified. And I remember years later talking to my mom about that, and she said, you know, every child looks like a monster sometimes. And that actually ended up being a line in the robot baby story. But I think that's part of it too. It's just this notion that, that things are never perfect. You know what I mean? And that we all have these sort of moments of horror or moments of failure or frailty.
You know, I'm a big lover of science fiction, and I think great science fiction is really about human beings encountering a strange world or forces that are outside of human experience. Yeah. And I think this film really is all about that. I mean, it's not. It's interaction with technology, but it's not on an epic scale. I mean, nobody gets killed by a plasma death ray.
our catchphrase for that is things don't blow up. A sci-fi fan told me that. I was trying to explain the film to him, and he nodded and he said, "Oh yeah, things don't blow up. That's cool. He could go with that."
Did you decide you wanted to kind of explore this human technological interaction in kind of a smaller way?
When I was thinking about making my first feature film as an independent filmmaker, these stories were things that had sort of come into my head over the years. And so while I was writing them, I was thinking about budget. Each one of the stories has one sort of crazy element in it. You know, we had to build the robot baby. We had to figure out how to make people look like androids. You know, we had to have this kind of digital breakup effect in the last story with the virtual world that's being depicted. But each one of those small, you know, challenges was totally surmountable given the budget we had. And then, you know, the notion of having science fiction and this kind of emotional human storytelling put together, I mean, that's something that I guess I didn't really think about that just because that was sort of second nature to me when I was writing these. And the fact that we didn't have much money, I think, actually really worked with that, you know, because it made us really concentrate on nailing that emotional story. I didn't have the money to get to spend, you know, 3/4 of the day trying to, make the 10-foot-tall giant robot crash through the streets of Manhattan, you know.
Is that in your folder, the plasma death ray machine is when you get a big budget?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually, there was a fifth robot story, which I outlined, and I was really sort of excited about it, and it did involve a 10-foot-tall robot, you know, crashing through the streets of Manhattan. But alas, that was not to be. You know, most robot movies are essentially Frankenstein movies. They're cautionary tales about technology gone awry. I mean, they're basically, original sin sort of fall of man stories about, forbidden knowledge and the fact that, you know, the notion that we will be destroyed by trying to assume God's prerogative, really, as creators.
Well, it's interesting because it seems to me that the closest we get to that in yours is the last one, in which it concerns a world in which people, as they approach death, upload their consciousness into a computer and, in effect, granting them kind of a digital eternal life. And the central character is an old artist confronting his death, and his son and his friends are saying, "Dad, it's time to upload." And he resists it. Was this sort of a cautionary tale? I mean, about where science could take us.
I think it's interesting because people use the term cautionary tale a lot, and I think certainly it is that. I wasn't necessarily thinking of it as a cautionary tale when I was writing it. I think I was thinking more of this notion that this will actually be something that we very well may have to confront in the next, say, 50 to 100 years, this notion of that we may be able to shift our consciousness into machines, basically, and have it endure forever. And so at a certain point, we're going to have to decide whether or not that's something we really want to do. You know, I think it is a genuine, clearly by the end of it, the artist makes a decision and goes, and makes a choice. And so the film, implies, probably gives the implication that one choice is superior to another. But at the same time, I think that, there's a lot to be said for the other side, and the film doesn't necessarily try to paint the other side as sheer villainy. I think when folks watch the movie, they bring a lot of themselves to it. And, when folks, some folks are, very attracted to sort of both sides of the argument. The other side of the argument is represented by his wife, who died as a young woman and was scanned and lives in this digital world, has sort of achieved this kind of perfect serenity. It's a very optimistic view of what this kind of experience would create. The idea is that once you get scanned, your consciousness can interact with the sum total of all human knowledge. With everybody else who has ever been scanned, you can sort of instantly tap into that. And it's sort of like instant access to the infinite. And it assumes that, once you're able to do that, you achieve this kind of nirvana, this peace. Like I say, that may or may not happen. Maybe it would just drive you insane. But anyway, but her state is, some people may admire that, or some people may think that's something to be, that would be something to strive for. The artist, though, I mean, his struggle is that he doesn't feel like he deserves that kind of peace and that kind of perfection without having earned it, which is a sort of a more organic, I guess, way to think about it.
Right. One of the things that struck me as I watched the film was the remarkable sounds, the sounds that you gave the robots. Did that require a lot of thought? Did you have any particular approach there?
Oh, yeah. I had a great sound designer named Nelson Nudd, who, this was like his second project. And he's, Nelson and I just recorded all kinds of different electronic sounds. I recorded every single like hard drive I had in my office and home, and the CD player and my iPod and all of these kind of things.
A lot of it, it struck me that a lot of it will be very familiar to people who use Windows or computer, We were trying to sort of bridge the technology of today to the technology of the future there.
I love the fact that there are familiar sounds in there. I mean, like the sound of a hard drive. We hear that every day, our hard drive spinning up and spinning down, but we don't think about it. And in the movie, the hard drive spinning up and spinning down, the character I play, Archie, he's this android who is programmed to interact with people so that he can fit in well with the office. He's programmed to be very friendly and to learn how people want him to behave in the office, but nobody wants to interact with him, so he kind of has his crisis moment as a result. He can't fulfill his programming. He can't connect. But whenever Archie is, whenever somebody is nice to Archie, you hear his hard drive spin up, and whenever somebody's mean to him, you hear it spin down, And I just kind of like that, using those sort of very familiar sounds, giving them emotional context.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Archie, because that's the role that you play. Very convincingly. I mean, you're a guy who's trained to be an office worker, literally walks himself in someday and says things like, "I look forward to our interactions." How did you prepare yourself to be a robot?
When I was writing that particular screenplay, I just kind of felt Archie. You know what I mean? I'd acted for years mainly doing improv comedy in New York City, but I just hadn't put myself into that many things because I wanted to really know that I could nail it and just really feel it before I cast myself in something. But so, first off, I just felt like I got Archie just on an emotional level. I mean, I think anybody who's ever felt, sort of out on the outside.
He's a machine, Greg. How can you get him on an emotional level?
Because I'm a geek, you know what I mean? And all all of us geeks, we, you know, we have our moments of, our frontier moments of sadness and isolation, you know, so I can relate to Archie.
You kind of had to show and, emotional development with these sort of fixed eyes. I mean, that had to be an interesting challenge.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I mean, I loved it, actually, because it's like, what we ended up, and I worked a lot with Julianne Henselka Kim, who plays the other robot, the female android, and also with Bill Coleus, who is great actor and just a amazing guy, who played the office worker who's responsible for Archie. He plays the tech guy in the office. And just in talking with both of them, you know, and just working on it, we kind of figured out some ground rules. And some of those ground rules involved just, all of them involved limitation, you know. And it was the idea that these robots wouldn't be as flexible as humans. They wouldn't be as quite as mobile. That every single movement that they did would be thought through, you know. 99% of the things that I do every day, just physically, I don't think about. You know what I mean? It's like I scratch my head, I don't think about it. I don't think about how each of my fingers works when I'm picking up a piece of paper or a pencil. I don't, you know, there's a million small movements that I make that I never think about. But when I was playing Archie, I thought about, you know, like Archie had to consciously choose every single motion he made. And that was hugely helpful, you know. It means that you limit the number of motions you make, but then when you do make a motion, it has intention to it.
My guest is director Greg Pak. His film Robot Stories is being released across the country. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with film director Greg Pak. His new film is Robot Stories. Most of the characters in the film are Asian American, though the film is shot entirely in English and appears to be set in the United States. Do you see anything particularly Asian in the themes or appeal of Robot Stories?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I'm biracial. I'm half Korean and half white, and I grew up I grew up in a mixed race household and biculturally, I guess, if you want to put it that way. But I always saw these characters as Asian or as mixed race. It kind of reflects the world in which I live. It's sort of genuinely multiculturally cast with, you know, white, black, Asian actors of all, you know, sort of colors and creeds. I think there are a couple of sort of reasons for that. I mean, one is just personal. You know what I mean? It's like Scorsese, you know, makes a lot of movies with Italian Americans in them. Woody Allen makes a lot of movies with Jewish people in them. You know, Brothers McMullen, made by an Irish American, has a lot of Irish Americans in it. And we all accept that. And I think I want to live in a world where we can all accept the same sort of the same thing from an Asian American director. Why not?
Right.
I purposefully cast the two robots, for example, with mixed race actors. Both Julianne Henselka Kim and I are both half Korean. And I did that because I think that when they actually make robots that look like people, they're going to make them racially ambiguous because they're going to try to sell them in many different markets. We already see that kind of in sort of artificially created characters. Like in Japanese animation, the characters are all very racially ambiguous. And, you know, they're sort of intended for this international market.
You always loved film and TV, but then you go off and you study political science at Yale. You study history at Oxford. Did you always think you wanted to get back to film or television, or were you going to be an academic?
Well, you know, the first thing I ever thought that I was going to be is a writer. You know, from the age of 9 or 10, I was writing short stories and stuff like that, and that was what I thought of myself as. I was also drawing cartoons and doing black and white photography and, and acting and stuff. But all of that stuff at a certain point, you know, in my head, became extracurricular. You know, I kept doing that all the way through. I mean, I did improv comedy all the time, and even stand-up, actually, during all the time I was working in politics. But there was some part of me that didn't let myself think of that as real work, you know? I grew up as a, you know, mixed-race kid in Dallas, Texas, and loved the people I grew up with, but at the same time was very aware of racial justice from a very young age. It's funny, I can, you know,
What do you mean by that? Did you suffer discrimination?
Yeah, I don't want to make too much of this because, like, every kid, like, probably, you know, like, a fat kid would have more trouble than I did as a mixed-race kid. But I remember, you know, like, you know, from time to time I'd have these bad experiences with racist kids, kids I didn't know almost always. But, you know, I can remember being a Cub Scout and walking home from the bus stop and seeing another group of Cub Scouts in the park. And I went over the park and I was like, hi, you know, I wanted to say, hi, I'm a Cub Scout, too, and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and they did the Chinese-Japanese dirty knees thing where they pull their eyes and chant. And I remember... It's funny because I don't remember being sad. I don't remember crying. I just remember being angry, you know, mm-hmm. because I was a Cub Scout and I knew what this country was founded on, you know, and I had this, I mean, it's kind of, I crack myself up when I think about that because at this very, very tender age, I had this huge amount of self-righteousness based on what I perceived as being the decent and strong and true principles of the country. So those kinds of issues were vitally important to me always, and I think that's one of the reasons why I was drawn to political science. My goal was to go back to Texas and work in politics, which I did. I went back home and worked for Ann Richards when she was running for office. But at the same time, at some point in there, I realized that something was missing. You know, I mean, the work I was doing was really important, but at the same time, on some level, I knew that there were probably 100,000 people out there who could be doing the same kind of stuff I was doing in that context.
Was it hard to then decide I'm going to let go of the serious career and do the thing that seemed like extra stuff?
You know, at a certain point, it just made sense. I mean, I got a scholarship to go to Oxford, and I was there for 2 years, and I was studying history, which was great because regardless of what I was doing, my ostensible reason for going was because studying history would make me a better politician because I hadn't had a very good background in history. And frankly, studying history makes you better at anything that you do. So I loved that program, but while I was there, I had the chance for the first time to get involved with filmmaking. And as soon as I started doing it, it just clicked. You know, I mean, I knew it was what I needed to do. I made a short film at Oxford called Lonely Street, which none shall ever see. But you know, even in that little short film, it was kind of interesting because it started off as just a kind of a film noir spoof or homage. But we cast it with a woman, you know, and it had this kind of, it was like this British female film noir, which was a detective story, basically. You know, so even at that stage, I was kind of thinking, I mean, I kind of knew that movies in particular had this amazing potential to put different kinds of images up there, you know? It's like if that's your only motivation, if your only motivation for making films is to sort of like, fight the man, then you're probably going to make a lot of really bad movies, you know what I'm saying? Because people don't want to go see polemic films. That's not why people go to the movies. You know, and so I was always driven by this, I had this emotional response to movies. I wanted to tell stories that were compelling to me on a human level, and that's what I've continued to do. But at the same time, the things that motivated me to go into politics remain things that are important to me in filmmaking. And having the chance to put different faces up on screen means that in filmmaking, it means that you give people an opportunity to identify with, bond with, fall in love with people from totally different backgrounds.
Well, Greg Pak, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Filmmaker Greg Pak. His first feature film, Robot Stories, is opening in cities across the country over the next few weeks. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, scholar Daniel Matt. He'll tell us about his 15-year project to translate the Zohar, a central text of the centuries-old tradition of Jewish mysticism known as the Kabbalah. He's just published Volume 1. Also, Milo Miles reviews the new live recording by the Mekons. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies of the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Kabbalah is a mystical tradition within Judaism. It was an obscure cult for centuries, but in recent years, New Age spirituality seekers began to look into its arcane texts and unique forms of meditation. Madonna, Roseanne, and Britney Spears are some of the celebrities who've attended classes at the trendy Kabbalah Center in Los Angeles. The primary text of Kabbalah is the Zohar, and my guest Daniel Matt has returned to its original Aramaic manuscripts to produce what he believes will be the first truly usable English translation. It's a massive undertaking, expected to take as long as 15 years. The first of what will be 12 volumes was published late last year. Daniel Matt is a professor of Jewish spirituality at Berkeley's Graduate Theological Union. The Zohar appeared at the end of the 13th century. It's a novel that's been described as a spiritual fantasy filled with humor and eroticism. It tells the story of a group of rabbis who wander among the hills of Galilee. Through their adventures and the unlikely characters they encounter, they discover new radical interpretations of the stories in the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament. Who wrote the Zohar?
That's still something of a mystery. The Zohar first emerged in Spain in the 13th century. The man who made it available was a Jewish mystic, a Kabbalist named Moses de Leon. He claimed that he was copying from an ancient manuscript that went back to the 2nd century and that the Zohar had been composed in the circle of a famous rabbi, Rabbi Shimon, the son of Yochai. And many people accepted that claim, and it was really because of that ancient heritage that the Zohar was seen really as a canonical text, and that really paved the way for the acceptance of Kabbalah. But modern scholars are fairly agreed that Moses de Leon was himself not just the scribe, but the composer, the author of the Zohar, or at least of much of the Zohar.
Why wouldn't he have claimed authorship rather than attribute it to someone many, many centuries before? Why not get all of the glory that comes with writing such a text?
Yeah, according to one account, his wife actually asked him that. And it's unclear. It may have been that he wanted these teachings to be accepted as traditional. If he had come out and offered some of his radical ideas and just said, you know, I have an idea God is a woman, or I have an idea God needs the human being, some of the radical insights of the Zohar that we'll discuss. If he had come out and just presented these as his own innovations, they may well have been rejected.
You have mentioned that the Zohar embodies a lot of radical reinterpretations of ancient biblical writings, the Torah. What do you mean by that? What's an example?
One example is that I would say the gender of God. Of course, almost all Western religion depicts God in predominantly masculine terms. God is Father in heaven, God is the King, God is the Judge. And the Zohar insists that God is equally male and female. So the feminine presence of God, known in Hebrew as Shekhinah, the immanence of God, that word actually is not an invention of the Kabbalah. You find it in earlier Jewish tradition. But in the Kabbalah, the Shekhinah becomes overtly feminine. So God is now seen as half male and half female, and the human task is to unite these two halves of God, which I would say means to actualize the divine potential in the world. How is that done? Through ethical, spiritual action. So that's one example.
There's a lot of eroticism in the text, isn't there?
It's a very erotic text, and that's probably part of its appeal over the ages. Not only does it describe human eros and human romance, but it depicts God as involved in the masculine-feminine union. And the wedding of God, the union of God, is really one of the main focuses of the Zohar.
Who was God marrying?
God really marries herself, or him and herself. We mentioned there's a masculine half of God and a feminine half of God, and the spiritual task is to wed the two of them, to bring the two together. So, for example, the Sabbath is seen as God's wedding, and that has been popularized in Jewish liturgy in the prayer Lecha Dodi, come, my beloved, to greet the bride. So the bride in the Jewish prayer book is depicted as the Sabbath queen, but on another level, the feminine half of God who is ushered into union with the Holy One, blessed be He, the masculine half of God.
You had another passage which you thought gives us an example of one of these radical retreatments of classical Jewish texts, the Torah.
We all know the story of the Garden of Eden, and of course Genesis says very explicitly that God expelled Adam from the garden. But the Zohar asks here one of its radical questions. It says, who threw whom out of the garden? Did God throw out Adam or not? And that pregnant not actually unfolds in the Zohar. And the Zohar says, really, in a deeper sense, Adam expelled God from the garden. You might say that we're really still in the garden, but we don't realize it because we've lost touch with the divine. We've excluded the spiritual dimension from our life. So the mystical challenge becomes reacquainting ourselves with God, reestablishing an intimacy with the divine.
So it was perhaps Adam that threw God out of the garden.
That's what the Zohar actually says, one of the most radical teachings imaginable. Adam threw God out, or Adam divorced God.
My guest is scholar and writer Daniel Matt. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is scholar and writer Daniel Matt. He's currently engaged in a multi-year project of translating the Zohar. That's the prime text of Kabbalah, the movement of Jewish mysticism. Well, Daniel Matt, let's talk a little bit about how Kabbalah developed. A lot of people are surprised to discover that it was associated with Hasidim, who I think most people would regard as sort of the most traditional of Jews. I mean, those who wear black hats and long beards. How did they interact with the Zohar and with the spread of Kabbalah?
Right. Well, Kabbalah really emerges in the 12th and 13th centuries in Western Europe. Certainly it has more ancient roots in the Bible itself and in Rabbinic Judaism, where you have different descriptions of direct contact with God, direct experience with the divine. But Kabbalah is a movement within Judaism, is a medieval phenomenon. And at first, it is really confined to relatively small circles. In Spain, where the Zohar is composed, the Zohar was probably read by a very small number of people. Gradually, over the centuries, Kabbalah spreads to wider circles. And Hasidism, which emerges in the 18th century as a mystical revivalist movement in Eastern Europe, Hasidism could really be seen as the popularization of the Kabbalah. In other words, it takes certain ideas from Jewish mysticism and tries to spread them to the masses, tries to build a community based on this mystical theology.
There's been some controversy around the Kabbalist Center, which I guess began in Los Angeles and has spread, which seems to offer life transformation and 10 easy lessons, but maybe doesn't approach the sort of density or richness of the Zohar. How do you regard this presentation of Kabbalah?
I have mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, they certainly have contributed to the spread of Kabbalah and the awareness of Kabbalah on the part of many groups who otherwise would not have encountered it. But there is an inevitable dilution, I think, with popularizing the Kabbalah, and I have to be careful of that in my own work. And, you know, claiming that if you drink certain water that's been rendered holy, or that if you wear a string around your wrist, that this will have a magical effect, I don't think that's really a healthy spirituality for contemporary Americans.
You mentioned the string. Britney Spears, I believe, appeared on the cover of Entertainment Weekly with a sexy outfit and a red string around her left wrist. What is the significance of the string?
This is something that is not really inherently Kabbalistic. It goes back to certain folk lore in Judaism and perhaps in the wider Mediterranean world. in which that color would protect you from the evil eye.
And that's sold, I'm told, at the Kabbalist Center for $26, and you can get Kabbalah water for a fee, and $415 sets of the Zohar, which I've read are sold more to ward off danger than to study. Does this trouble you?
It certainly does, but I would say, you know, Kabbalah is not one thing. You can find elements of superstition and magic in Kabbalah itself. My approach is really to focus on the gems of Kabbalistic wisdom, the radical reinterpretation of the Bible, and not to indulge in superstitious practices, whether or not they have some basis in certain Kabbalistic traditions.
Well, Daniel Matt, what spurred you to take up this multi-year project of translating this ancient text, the Zohar?
I got a call from a friend of mine, Arthur Green, who said that a family in Chicago, the Pritzker family, was interested in commissioning a new translation of the Zohar. Apparently what had happened was that Margot Pritzker, in this family, began studying with a rabbi in Chicago, a fellow named Yechiel Pupko, prominent Orthodox rabbi in Chicago. They began studying Judaism, and because of Margot's interest in mysticism, they also delved into the Zohar, but they weren't satisfied with the existing English translation. This is a translation done many years ago in England. It's known as the Sansino translation. They were studying this and were frustrated because the Sansino translation is more a paraphrase than an accurate translation. It has no commentary, so the symbolism really remains impenetrable. And either Margot said to Rabbi Pupko or Rabbi Pupko said to her, why don't we commission a new translation? And they approached me and offered this to me, basically. I was overwhelmed. I didn't know what to do. I was very intrigued and very attracted by the possibility, but I knew how intense this would be and was worried that it might be overwhelming. So I took a month off and decided I'd give it a try.
So they were saying essentially, would you please take the next 15 years of your life and translate this massive text?
Yeah, I think that they didn't realize exactly how long it would take, but they certainly knew it would be a major commitment. And they turned to me and offered it to me, basically. So I tried it for this month, and after that month I decided I'm definitely not doing this. It was just too exhausting. I would work at it 6, 8, 9 hours and be totally drained, get up the next day and try again. And after a month of this, I said, no, this is too much.
Why was it so draining?
The Zohar is written in such a way that you really don't always, you often don't know what it means. To make sense of it, you have to meditate on the text. You have to scour dictionaries and reference works, but you also have to meditate within and see how the possible meanings resonate within yourself. So it's a meditative, contemplative undertaking, which is beautiful and fulfilling. But to do it for thousands of pages seemed to me just frightening.
Part of this involved getting the original texts, right? I mean, how did you collect them?
All translations up till now have been based simply on the standard Aramaic edition. And I thought I would do the same. But I had access to original manuscripts of the Zohar. I thought that when I ran across difficult passages, I would check these manuscripts. But after checking them a number of times, I began to discover that the manuscripts often preserved a reading superior to the printed edition. How could this happen? It's really because over the centuries, every scribe who copied the Zohar tried to add a little bit. A scribe would say, oh, this phrase is so difficult, I'll put in a word of explanation. Or sometimes the weird Aramaic would be smoothed away, and a scribe would substitute a more conventional, bland term. So some of the original beauty and lyrical strangeness of the Zohar was lost, and the printed edition really represents a doctored version. So what I decided to do by painstaking analysis was to scrape away hundreds of years of accretion, hundreds of years of scribal addition and doctoring of the text, to try to approach that elusive, hypothetical, original Zohar.
I want to ask you before we go about the Mel Gibson movie, The Passion of Christ. As someone who has spent a lifetime in Judaism and Jewish scholarship, how do you regard the message that it seems to bring?
Well, I would say, first of all, Jesus, of course, strikes people in very different ways. I see Jesus as a Jewish mystic. I see him as a profound Jewish teacher. I don't idolize Jesus. I don't see him as divine or any more divine than any of us could be. But I see him as a profound spiritual teacher. The gospel's presentation of Jesus and of the tragedy of his death does not necessarily reflect the historical reality of Jesus, of Jesus' own lifetime. And I think the problem with the movie is that it assumes that the gospels are totally historically accurate.
What do you see as the reality of the historical Jesus? What are the problems with treating the gospels as history?
You know, it's impossible to know what actually went on in the first century between Jesus and other Jews of his time. We certainly know that Jesus had no intention of starting a new religion, that he wanted simply to live Judaism and to find God through the Jewish faith and to bring other Jews to God. He certainly aroused opposition. Many people may not have been aware who he was or that he was doing anything, but he certainly inspired some Jews and threatened the Romans and certain conservative power structures within Judaism. So it's likely that he was executed by the Romans for rebelling or fomenting rebellion. But the problem is that when the Gospels are written several decades after the event, at that point there is an emerging church, there is rabbinic Judaism, and the Gospels are very hesitant to offend Rome or to blame anything on Rome. So it's convenient for the Gospels to paint a picture as if the Jews were partially or mostly responsible for the crucifixion, that way letting Rome somewhat off the hook. And that later account, which is canonized in the Gospels, is the basis for this film.
Are you concerned about it spreading anti-Semitic messages?
Certainly that is a danger. I would say that the Jews and Christians need to learn from each other's tradition, and perhaps this movie in its own way will encourage and stimulate that. I think Christians need to appreciate the meaning of Torah and all the forms that the Bible has taken in Jewish tradition, how it has unfolded over the centuries. And Jews can come to an appreciation of Jesus, not Jesus as divine, but Jesus as a Jewish teacher.
Well, Daniel, Matt, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Great, thank you.
Scholar and writer Daniel Matt. The first volume of his translation of the Zohar has just been published and was awarded the Koret Jewish Book Award. The musical Fiddler on the Roof, based on the Shalom Aleichem stories, has been revived on Broadway, unfortunately not to the greatest reviews. But critics and audiences alike still have a fondness for the music, written by Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bach. Here's a version of To Life, performed by Paul Shapiro's group Midnight Minion. Coming up, the rock band Mekons has a new CD. This is Fresh Air. The rock band The Mekons have a new CD called Punk Rock, with material from the band's early punk years dating back to 1977. They dusted off some of those old songs for their ambitious 25th anniversary tour in 2002. Music critic Milo Miles says the new album is more than just a look backwards.
Four years ago, the Mekons seemed to be a band finally winding down after a surprising series of rebounds. In the 1970s, they played chunky protest punk and were ignored. In the 1980s, they recast American country as the sound of wizened but still subversive losers and became cult darlings. Then they recharged their various rock and rhythm styles and became the most vital original punk band in the world. But in the 90s, they lost their way. The solo careers of key players like guitarist, singer, and songwriter John Langford and singer and songwriter Sally Timms seemed far more vital. The fact that their 25th anniversary tour in 2002 was filled with songs from 1977 to 1981 might seem like another exercise in rock retrospective. And on the surface, the new live album, Punk Rock, might suggest Fleetwood Mac doing a hardcore blues session. But also in 2002, the Mekons had released the studio album Out of Our Heads. And on that CD, brilliant songs like The Old Trip to Jerusalem and Hate is the New Love proclaimed that dread and madness had come upon the land again. So no wonder that Colin Stewart's liner notes to Punk Rock proclaim, "These half-forgotten tunes and texts were dusted down and probed for life, blowtorch applied to the musty stink and backward thrust of nostalgia." The Mekons roar that not only is past punk not dead, it's not even past anymore.
Takes days and weeks of your life to get a car. 3 days. 4 hours. Get a job. Get a car. It takes 1 week of your life to buy a mattress. 3 days. Get a job, get a car, get a bed. It takes 2 hours of your
The Mekons punk is not about high-speed beats and high-hormone youth anger. It's about lifetime amateurs committed to internal exile and cursed with external failure who are not going to give in and go away. Their punk rock is sometimes stark, acoustic, but always fierce. A terrific example is the song called The Building, cited by critic Greil Marcus as the ideal field recording of punk. The original 1981 version was nothing more than a rant accompanied by a rhythmic stomp. The new live version pares that down to just a rant.
I stand by the building in the pouring
we give our lives for the motherland. The men with dogs around the square. The men with dogs. Big dogs. They smile for the cameras and little girls. We're innocent until proven guilty. But we hide and we worry and we look away. Cause we're innocent until we're proven guilty. We hide and we worry and we look away.
If listening to punk rock makes you think about the changed state of the world rather than just the noisy music, the Mekons will have succeeded, and punk lives again.
Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. He reviewed punk rock by the Mekons on the Quarterstick label. The Mekons' new tour begins March 9th in Pittsburgh. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillig, and Jessica Chu. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Emperor, The Death of Kings, a novel about Julius Caesar's rise to power by Con Eagledon, author of Emperor, The Gates of Rome. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Understanding the Crisis in Haiti, we speak with writer Amy Wilentz. She translated the book of deposed President Jean-Bertrand Aristide and has written widely about the cycles of political violence in the country. And we hear from correspondent Kathy Klarich in Port-au-Prince. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.